So befriending the four quadrants and their truths makes it more likely that the deeper levels of consciousness will emerge in a more balanced and integral fashion. So in order to get all level, we first need to get all quadrant. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, I believe that is very true, yes.
So perhaps we could go around the four quadrants and very briefly summarize this. The four truths, what they are, and the tests for their validity. I mean, humanity has painfully learned and labored hard to fashion a series of validity claims, tests that can help us determine if we're in touch with the real, if we are adequately attuned to the cosmos in all of its rich diversity.
The validity claims are the ways that we connect to spirit itself, ways that we attune ourselves to the cosmos. The validity claims force us to confront reality. They curb our egoic fantasies and self-centered ways. They demand evidence from the rest of the cosmos. They force us outside of ourselves. They're the checks and balances in the cosmic constitution.
Is there any easy definition of truth?
Well, most people take truth to mean representational truth, simple mapping or simple correspondence. I make a statement or a proposition that refers to or represents something in the concrete world. For example, I might say, it's raining outside. Now we want to know if that is true or not. We want to know the validity or the truth status of that statement. So basically, we go and look outside. And if it is indeed raining, we can say that the statement, it is raining outside, is a true statement.
Or a true proposition.
Yes. It's a simple mapping procedure. We check to see if the proposition corresponds with or fits the facts, if the map accurately reflects the real territory. Usually it's more complicated, and we might try to disprove the map, and if we can never disprove it, we assume it's accurate enough. But the essential idea is that with representational or propositional truth, my statement somehow refers to an objective sphere, and it accurately corresponds with those objects or processes or affairs.
So propositional truth basically deals with just the exterior or objective or right-hand dimensions of the four quadrants.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Both the upper right and lower right quadrants contain the observable, empirical, exterior aspects of holons. We'll subdivide these in a moment into the upper and lower versions, but the point is that all right-hand holons have simple location. These aspects can be easily seen, and thus with propositional truth, we tie our statements to these objects or processes or affairs. This is also called, by the way, the correspondence theory of truth. All of which is fair enough and important enough, and I in no way deny the general importance of empirical representation. It's just not the whole story. It's not even the most interesting part of the story.
So an objective state of affairs, the brain, planets, organisms, ecosystems, can be represented with empirical mapping. These empirical maps are all variations on it is raining or some other kind of objective proposition.
Yes, but if we now look at the upper left, the actual interior of an individual holon, then we have an entirely different type of validity claim. The question here is not, is it raining outside? The question here is, when I tell you it's raining outside, am I telling you the truth or am I lying? You see, here it's not so much a question of whether the map matches the objective territory, but whether the mapmaker can be trusted. And not just about objective truths, but especially about interior truths. I mean, you can always check and see if it's raining. You can do that yourself. But the only way you can know my interior, my depth, is by asking me, by talking to me, as we've seen. And when I report on my inner status, I might be telling you the truth, but I might be lying. You have no other way to get at my interior except in talk and dialogue and interpretation. And I might fundamentally distort or conceal or mislead. In short, I might lie. So the way we tend to navigate in the right hand is by using the yardstick of propositional truth, or simply truth for short. But the way we navigate in the upper left is by using the yardstick of truthfulness, or sincerity, or honesty, or trustworthiness. This is not so much a matter of objective truth, but of subjective truthfulness. Two very different criteria, truth and truthfulness.
So those are two different validity claims.
Yes, that's right. And this is no trivial matter. Interior events are located in states of consciousness, not in objective states of affairs, and so you can't empirically nail them down with simple location. As we saw, they're accessed with communication and interpretation, not with a monological gaze. And in this communication, I might intentionally lie to you, for various reasons. I might try to misrepresent my interior. I might try to make it appear to be something other than it really is. I might dash the entire left-hand dimensions against the wall of deceitfulness. I might lie to you. Furthermore, and this is crucial, I might lie to myself. I might try to conceal aspects of my own depth from myself. I might do this intentionally, or I might do it unconsciously. But one way or another, I might misinterpret my own depth. I might lie about my own interior. And in part, the unconscious is the locus of all the ways I have lied to myself. I might have started lying to myself because of intense environmental trauma, or maybe I learned it from my parents, or maybe I had to do it as a defense mechanism against an even more painful truth. But in any event, my unconscious is the locus of my insincerity, of my being less than truthful with myself, less than truthful about my subjective depth, my interior status, my deep desires and intentions. The unconscious is the locus of the lie. Well, take psychoanalysis, for instance, and the interpretive therapies. Their goal is to provide more truthful interpretations. The point of depth psychology and therapy is to help people interpret themselves more truthfully. The left hand, of course, is interpretation, and so it's no surprise that truthful or more adequate interpretation is the central therapeutic criterion. The example we used was sad and mad about an absent father. What that means is that at some point early in my life, I started interpreting anger as depression. Perhaps I was enraged at my father for not being around. Well, this rage, however, is very dangerous for a child. What if this rage could actually kill my father? Perhaps I better not have this anger, because after all, I love my father. So I'm angry at myself instead. I beat myself up instead. I'm rotten, no good, wretched to the core. Well, this is very depressing. I started out mad. Now I'm calling it sad. One way or another, I've misinterpreted my interior. I've distorted my depth. I've started calling anger sadness, and I carry this lie around with me. I can't be truthful with myself, because that would involve such great pain, to want to kill the father I love. So I would rather lie about the whole thing. And so this I do. My shadow, my unconscious, is now the locus of this lie, the focal point of this insincerity, the inner place that I hide from myself. And because I lie to myself, and then forget it is a lie, then I will lie to you without even knowing it. I will probably even seem very sincere about it. In fact, if I have thoroughly lied to myself, I will honestly think I'm telling the truth. And if you give me a lie detector test, it will show that I'm telling the truth. So much for empirical tests. Finally, because I have misinterpreted my own depth, I will often misinterpret yours. I'm cutting something off in my own depth. I'm dissociating it, or repressing it, or alienating it. And so I'll distort interpretations from that depth, both in myself and in others. My interpretations will be laced with lies, nested in insincerity. I will misinterpret myself, and I will often misinterpret you. And you'll probably notice this. Notice that something is off base. I'll say something so wacky you'll have to respond, "Oh, that's not what I meant." And you'll think to yourself, "Where on earth did he get that one?"
So these various interpretive therapies, such as psychoanalysis, or Gestalt, or Jungian analysis, help you to contact and more truthfully interpret your depths.
Yes, exactly. The idea is not to make some sort of more accurate map of the objective world, but to relax your resistances and sink into your interior depths, and learn to report those depths more truthfully, both to others and to yourself. And this allows your depth to begin to match your behavior. Your words and your actions will match up. That is, your left will match your right. You will walk your talk. And your left hand will know what your right hand doeth. We generally refer to this as integrity. You have the sense that the person won't lie to you because they haven't lied to themselves. Of course, if you live in the world of the lab technician, the empiricist, the behaviorist, the systems theorist, the cybernetic scurrying, the monological madness, you don't particularly care about interior truthfulness, because you don't particularly care about interiors, period. Not in their own terms, anyway. You just want monological truth, objective surfaces, empirical behavior, systems, networks, and you don't care about interior depth and sincerity and truthfulness. In fact, there is nothing on the empirical maps that even vaguely corresponds with truthfulness. Truthfulness, you see, doesn't have simple location, and it is not a merely empirical state of affairs, so it appears on none of the empirical maps. Not on a physicist's map, not on a biologist's map, not on a neurologist's map, not on a systems theory map, not on an ecosystem map. It's a left-hand, not a right-hand affair. And yet, in that left-hand exists your entire life world, your actual awareness, your own depth. And if you're alive to depth at all, you'll come to know that depth in yourself and in others through truthfulness and sincerity and trustworthiness. The essential point is that the way to depth is blocked by deceit, blocked by deception. And the moment you acknowledge interiors, you must confront the primary roadblock to accessing those interiors. You must confront deception and deceit, which is precisely why we navigate in this domain by truthfulness. And yes, that is what all left-hand therapies work with, more truthful interpretations of your own inner depth.
Yet different interpretive therapies do have different types of interpretations.
Well, yes, and that's a long discussion. Perhaps I could just say that the different interpretive therapies differ primarily on how deep they're willing to go in their interpretations, or how high they're willing to go. The upper left quadrant is, as we were saying, a spectrum of consciousness, a spectrum of levels of developmental awareness. And different therapies tend to plug into different levels of this spectrum and use their favorite level as the basic reference point around which they'll offer their interpretations. As we saw, all interpretation is context-bound, and different therapies have their own favorite context within which they offer their interpretations. Well, this doesn't mean that they're wrong, only that we have to identify their context, their favorite level. We have to situate their interpretations. Freudians emphasize the emotional sexual level. Cognitive therapists emphasize the verbal. Transpersonal therapists emphasize the spiritual. But they all primarily confront the distortions, the lies and self-deceptions with which we hide truthful aspects of these dimensions from ourselves, the lies and distortions that obscure our emotions, our self-esteem, our spiritual nature.
So a full spectrum model would be a type of composite story, including all the various levels of the spectrum of consciousness and the therapies that are most effective for each level?
Yes, that's one of the tasks of a full spectrum model. My basic point about these left-hand or interpretive therapies is that once we strip them of their exclusiveness or their single-level partialness, then they all have something very important to teach us. They all have something to tell us about the various layers of the self, of consciousness, and about the truthful interpretations that can help us access these various dimensions. Because the amazing fact is that truth alone will not set you free. Truthfulness will set you free.
Okay, so what about the lower left quadrant?
The crucial point is that the subjective world is situated in an intersubjective space, a cultural space. And it's this intersubjective space that allows the subjective space to arise in the first place. Without this cultural background, my own individual thoughts would have no meaning at all. I wouldn't even have the tools to interpret my own thoughts to myself. In fact, I wouldn't even have developed thoughts. In other words, the subjective space is inseparable from the intersubjective space. And this is one of the great discoveries of the postmodern or post-enlightenment movements. So here, in the lower left quadrant, the validity claim is not so much objective propositional truth and not so much subjective truthfulness, but intersubjective fit. This cultural background provides the common context against which my own thoughts and interpretations will have some sort of meaning. And so the validity criterion here involves the cultural fit with this background.
So the aim of this validity claim is what exactly? I mean, we have objective truth. We have subjective truthfulness, and we have intersubjective what?
The aim here is mutual understanding. Not that we necessarily agree with each other, but can we at least understand each other? Because if that can't happen, then we'll never be able to exist in a common culture. Can you and I arrange our subjective spaces so that we see eye to eye? Can we find a common cultural background that allows communication to exist in the first place? Can we find a cultural fit, a common meaning between ourselves? This must happen to some degree before any communication can occur at all.
So the aim here is not so much the mapping of objective truth and not simply being truthful, but reaching mutual understanding.
That's right. And this has many, many aspects. You and I are going to have to agree on some sort of morals and ethics if we're going to live in the same space. And we're going to have to find some sort of common law. And we're going to have to find some sort of identity that overlaps our individual selves and shows us something in common, some sort of collective identity, so that we can see something of ourselves in each other and treat each other with care and concern. All of that is involved in this cultural fit, this background of common meaning and appropriateness and justness. I've been describing this background as if it were some sort of contract that you and I consciously form, like a social contract. And sometimes it is. Sometimes we simply reach mutual agreement about, for example, the voting age or the speed limit on the highway. That's part of cultural fit, of how we agree on rules and common meanings that allow us all to fit together. But much of cultural fit is not a conscious contract. Much of it is so deeply background that we hardly know it's there. There are linguistic structures and cultural practices so deeply contextual that we're still trying to dig them up and understand them. But the point is, wherever they come from, there's no escaping these intersubjective networks that allow the subjective space to develop in the first place. What's so remarkable about mutual understanding is not that I can take a simple word like dog and point to a real dog and say, I mean that. What's so remarkable is that you know what I mean by that. Forget the simple empirical pointing. Instead, look at this intersubjective understanding. It's utterly amazing. It means you and I can inhabit each other's interior to some degree. You and I can share our depth. When we point to truth and we're situated in truthfulness, we can reach mutual understanding. This is a miracle. If spirit exists, you can begin to look for it here.
So this is cultural fit or justness.
Yes, justness, goodness, rightness. How do we reach the common good? What's right and appropriate for us, such that we can all inhabit the same cultural space with some sort of dignity and fairness? How do we arrange our subjective spaces so that they mesh in the common intersubjective space, the common world space, the common culture, upon which we have all depended for our own subjective being? This is not a matter of arranging objects in the space of a simple location. It's a matter of arranging subjects in the collective interior space of culture. This is not simply truthfulness, and not simply the true, but the good.
So as you say, cultural fit or justness includes all sorts of items, from ethics and morals and laws, to group or collective identities, to background cultural contexts, and so on?
Mm-hmm. All of which we've been summarizing as a common worldview or world space, which we also called cultural, that is, the lower left quadrant. And remember, this cultural space exists for all holons, even though it might be simpler and less complex. So there is intersubjectivity woven into the very fabric of the cosmos at all levels. This is not just the spirit in me, not just the spirit in it, not just the spirit in them, but the spirit in us, all of us.
What's the difference, then, between the upper right quadrant and the lower right quadrant? You said they have a different validity claim?
The upper right quadrant is exteriors of just individuals. The lower right is exteriors of systems. So the upper right is propositional truth in the very strictest sense. A proposition refers to a single fact. But in the lower right, the proposition refers to the social system, whose main validity claim is functional fit, how various holons fit together in the overall objective system. It's true that both the lower right and lower left quadrants are dealing with systems in the broad sense, because the entire lower half is the communal or the collective. But the lower left describes that system from within, from the interior. It describes the consciousness, the values, the worldviews, the ethics, the collective identities. But the lower right describes the system in purely objective and exterior terms, from without. It doesn't want to know how collective values are intersubjectively shared in mutual understanding. Rather, it wants to know how their objective correlates functionally fit in the overall social system, which itself has simple location. Open any good book on systems theory, for example, and you'll find nothing about ethical standards, intersubjective values, moral dispositions, mutual understanding, truthfulness, sincerity, depth, integrity, aesthetics, interpretation, beauty, art, the sublime. Open any systems theory text, and you'll find none of that even mentioned. All you'll find are the objective and exterior correlates of all that. All you'll find in systems theory are information bits scurrying through processing channels and cybernetic feedback loops and processes within processes of dynamic networks.
So let's look at a specific example to clarify the difference between the lower left quadrant and cultural fit on the one hand, and the lower right quadrant and functional fit on the other. And let's take, for example, the American Indian view of the rain dance from a cultural perspective versus a social one.
Okay. The lower left approach studies the community by becoming a participant observer and attempts to understand it from within. Remember, the validity criteria in the lower left is mutual understanding. And this you attempt to do by becoming a participant observer. You enter the interior meaning of the community. And you understand this meaning only by understanding its cultural fit, by understanding what the meaning of the dance is, based on how it fits into the vast background of cultural and linguistic meanings and practices. And the participant observer, the interpreter, might find that, as we said, the dance is part of a sacred ritual with nature. That is its interior meaning, which you understand by immersing yourself in this cultural background, which will give you the common world space or common context against which you can now make adequate interpretations. Now, the standard system scientist or standard systems theorist is not primarily interested in any of that, in any of the interior meaning. Rather, systems theory is interested in the function that the dance performs in the overall social system. According to this view, what a particular American Indian nation says this dance means is not so important. What's really important is that the dance is part of an objective social system, and this objective system in many ways determines what the individual participants are doing. The real function of the dance is to provide regulatory self-maintenance of the system. The dance is thus part of the social system's attempt to maintain its social integration, its functional fit. It provides a common ritual around which social cohesion is organized. And this can be determined by observing the dance from an objective stance, an empirical or objective stance. You can even make a monological flowchart out of it, which, believe me, is not how a given American Indian nation experiences the dance at all.
But I suppose that, again, you yourself don't think that one of those approaches is right while the other is wrong.
Well, they're both correct, in my opinion. One approaches the socio-cultural whole on from within, the other from without. One is how subjects fit together in cultural space, how you and I reach mutual understanding or intersubjectivity. The other is how objects fit together in physical space, in the total objective system, in interobjectivity. The one uses interpretation of interior depth. The other uses empirical analytic observation or objective analysis of observable behavior. What does it mean versus what does it do? Both are entirely valid. They are each the correlates of the other. They are, in fact, the left and right hands of spirit as it manifests in the collective.
Okay, so we have four different quadrants, each with a different type of truth or a different voice, and each has a different test for its truth or a different validity claim.
Right. All of these are valid forms of knowledge because they're grounded in the realities of the four facets of every holon. And therefore, all four of these truth claims can be redeemed, can be confirmed or rejected by a community of the adequate. They each have a different validity claim, which carefully guides us through checks and balances on our knowledge quest. They are all falsifiable in their own domains, which means false claims can be dislodged by further evidence from that domain. So let us gently ignore the claims of any one quadrant, that it alone has the only falsifiable test there is, so it alone has the only truth worth knowing. And over the centuries and millennia, humanity has, by very painful trial and error, learned the basic procedures for these tests for truth.
Which is why, of course, they're so important.
Definitely. These truths are the golden treasure of a collective humanity, hard won through blood and sweat and tears and turmoil in the face of falsity, error, deception, and deceit. Humanity has slowly and increasingly learned over a million-year history to separate truth from appearance, goodness from corruption, beauty from degradation, and sincerity from deception. And ultimately, these four truths are simply the four faces of spirit as it shines in the manifest world. The validity claims are the ways that we connect to spirit itself, ways that we attune ourselves to the cosmos. As we said at the beginning of this discussion, the validity claims force us to confront reality. They curb our egoic fantasies and self-centered ways. They demand evidence from the rest of the cosmos. They force us outside of ourselves. They're the checks and balances in the cosmic constitution. And so, following these paths to truth, we fit with the flow of the cosmos. We're delivered into currents that take us outside of ourselves, beyond ourselves, and force us to curb our self-serving ways as we fit into ever deeper and wider circles of truth. From attunement to atonement to at-one-ment. Until, with a sudden and jolting shock, we recognize our own original face, the face that was smiling at us in each and every truth claim, the face that all along was whispering ever so gently, but always so insistently, "Let truth and truthfulness and goodness and beauty shine as the seals of a radiant spirit that would never and could never abandon us."
This concludes Session 2 of A Brief History of Everything by Ken Wilber. Our program continues with Session 3.